Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Kai Wortmann, working in philosophy of education at the University of Tübingen, and I'm here today with Anna Honaker to talk about her new book, Pragmatic Humanism Revisited, an essay on making the world a home. In this book, Anna proposes pragmatist answers to some of the most existential questions of our life. Questions about how to live a good life, questions about God, and even about death. The book is very elegantly written, and it was both intellectually stimulating and a great pleasure to read, so I'm really happy to have the author here. Anna, welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Before talking about the book, can you maybe start off by saying a bit about your background? What brought you into philosophy, and what made you interested in pragmatism?
So I guess we start with a really, really big question. What brought me to philosophy? So in a very broad sense, I always liked to ask questions and to doubt everything and to look behind what I was told. So, and I think that accompanies me until today, that I think philosophy is a critical tool. So in a way, I've been a philosopher all my life. But of course, there's something as professional philosophy, and that, of course, took a little bit longer. And I think it was particularly a teacher at high school who brought me to the discipline of philosophy and who asked the big question and make it an experience to philosophize. And then I decided I want to give it a try to be a professional philosopher. And that's how I ended up.
And then you worked heavily in the pragmatist tradition. What drew you to this instead of, say, analytic philosophy or other continental philosophies?
Well, that is, of course, a contingent thing. And actually, I started when I studied philosophy at the University of Münster. I did a lot of analytical philosophy and philosophy of science. It's what you do nowadays when you're doing philosophy. And I was very interested in analytical philosophy of mind. So that's where I come from. And then it was even after I started doing my PhD that I came into contact with William James and the pragmatist tradition. And it was because I had to prepare a talk and I read a text by a theologian. And in this text, the author said, pragmatist thinking, pragmatist theology is crap. Don't read that. It's useless and it's doesn't make any sense. So
you wanted to find out yourself whether
it's crap. Exactly. And that was the moment when I started reading William James.
And you found out it is not that crappy, actually.
Actually, I fell in love with William James at that moment, and I found it very, very modern, though it's not that, I mean, it's been a while that William James tackled the problems, but the problems he tackled are still very, very up to date, I think. So the questions of how can you believe in a modern pluralist world? I think that's a question that still lingers today. And the answers he tries to give very appealing, at least to me. So that's how I came to the pragmatist tradition.
That's a great way to start talking about the book. But before talking about your pragmatist perspective and James a little bit in more detail, maybe we can start with the title, Making the World a Home. What does that mean?
So I think that pretty much sums up the overall aim of the book, that philosophy is, of course, it's and especially as a profession, it's a theoretical account to the world and to understand the world, but especially the pragmatist thinking is about finding a way how to live well and to find a philosophy in the broadest sense that is a Weltanschauung, a worldview, and that is not only a theoretical thing, but also a practical thing. It leads you, it navigates you through the jungle of life, and it helps you to make sense of everything. And so it's the metaphor of making the world a home is trying to pin that down, that it's not only theory, but it's about finding a theory that helps you living. And that creates, in the words of William James, intimacy with the world. So it has to fit the world, meaning your life experience, your everyday experience. And by finding positions and perspectives on that world, in a way you don't have to feel as a stranger anymore. But that's still another metaphor. I don't know if it's really helpful to explain metaphors by metaphors.
Yeah, it is. It is. I think you call it also in the book philosophy for real human beings. So I suppose in opposition to professional philosophers, it has to offer something for the readers, not only in terms of intellectual joy and intellectual puzzles and intellectual riddle solving, but also for actually living in the world.
Exactly. And I wouldn't make the dichotomy too strong. I really think that professional philosophy should do this, but we all know that what's done at universities all too often has a strong focus, to say the least, on the purely theoretical side. And I mean, that's something that most of the classical pragmatists and also the neo-pragmatists criticize about professional philosophy, because they don't want to make this dichotomy of there's something like professional philosophy that's done in academia, and then there's something like popular philosophy that's for the usual people. but it's the very, very challenge or the very aim of philosophy to help people to live their lives. And
And I suppose when we now turn to the pragmatist perspective in your book, this function of philosophy also played a role in the life of your two main authors, William James and Ferdinand Canning Scott Schiller. Because at least James was very melancholic, and today you would say probably he was depressed. And he really tried to think philosophically in order to tackle these melancholic impulses in his life, I think.
Absolutely. So perhaps a main term you can use for describing the starting point of his thinking and his philosophizing is crisis. He had a lot of philosophical crises that are not really to be separated from life crisis. So the questions of, for example, of free will, of the reality of values, of the worth and meaning of life are philosophical questions, but it matters how you answer them. And William James really very much felt that if you give an answer to, for example, the question of free will, that is saying, no, you don't have free will, because in his time and up to date, it's if you have, if you say that the world and everything that happens is determined, so if you're an adherent of determinism, you say if everything is determined, you can't have a free will. I know that's only one option, but if you say that, then what does it mean for your life? It's exactly the pragmatist insight that it's not only a theoretical position. It tells you something, and it makes something with you if you know or if you think that it's true that you don't have a free will, or that there's no morality or something like that. So William James really struggled with these questions, not as a philosophical hobby, but as life questions.
What I really like about your book was that it kind of dramatizes these questions and make them very existential. And I think that's a very helpful way to think about pragmatism, because it is all very often portrayed as very superficial and capitalist, and it comes from America, and therefore we already know that it is intimately connected with all the evil in the world. And it often reads as, also because James is a very elegant writer, it sometimes makes the impression that it rather avoids the big question than tries to tackle them. But I think the reason is that the answers are actually so different from the usual way we answer them. So this doesn't lead to a question now, but I really like your way of making these pragmatist answers to these existential questions really dramatic. Was maybe I can turn this into a question and say, was this on purpose, or was there a strategy behind it?
You made a very important point when you hinted to the reception, at least in the German reception of pragmatism, as something superficial or something that is very optimistic and concentrating on feasibility. And so I really, at least when I started reading William James, I had a completely different experience. And after all these years, I still stick to this impression that it has a very dark, very melancholic side, and it has a sense for the failures of human practices, and it has a stands for the tragic. So it was indeed important to me to underline that, to highlight that dimension of pragmatist thinking. And the other point, perhaps to avoid any disappointments for possible readers, I think it is another pragmatist insight that there are no fixed answers. So in a way, I don't try to give answers to the readers to what's the meaning of life. I cannot do that. And I think it's something like intellectual honesty to lay out that it's not possible to give universal answers, but to tell people that they can find answers for their own lives. But they have
provisional,
to give them. Yeah.
Provisional answers. That's a great point to turn to the first, because your book contains four chapters on four different topics: science, religion, ethics, and death. And this would be a good starting point to talk about science, because often pragmatism is connected as first and foremost philosophy of science or theory of truth or something like that. So maybe you can start off by saying something about your way of making the question of science relevant for these existential questions.
Well, I think this is a point we have to handle very careful, because I don't want to signal that science isn't important or that we cannot trust scientific findings. And by no way I want to to say that science is not relevant to our everyday lives. On the contrary, it is very relevant. And I think the last month through the pandemic made it very, very clear, and it will be very crucial for tackling problems like climate change. But my starting point with respect to this chapter was that a lot of people who turned down religious worldviews started to focus on science as pseudo-religion or as a substitute for religion, and think that not only that the natural world is all there is, so there are no angels, no demons, no gods, but that science is the only way to truth. So that's what I call scientism. So when science turns into a worldview, and I think that's actually problematic. I try to elaborate on how pragmatism is very serious about scientific inquiry, but at the same time abstains from making science a new religion. So I think that's the point, the middle path I want to lay out.
So on the one hand, it is about not about denying the worth of science, but also not saying that science is the only or the most privileged or the best way to know about reality and to know about what is really there. Is that a good way to put it?
Well, yes, in a way, yes. But again, science is, I mean, without science, the world would be completely different, and I do not want to go back in a pre-science era. It is only that a certain account of looking at science, of understanding science as something neutral, because I think with pragmatism we can focus on the fact that science is something done by people. There's, I mean, we tend to think of science as something abstract, but science is something that people do and that is funded, and that scientific processes happen in a certain context and in certain situations with a certain goal. And this is something we should also have in mind when we look at scientific findings. And so,
what then is the consequences of when we look, for example, today we struggle with interpreting the findings of the virologists and epidemiologists about what to do for or against, rather against the corona crisis. So what would you say is the practical insight then of your pragmatist perspective?
Well, the position I'm arguing against would be a position that says that there's no need for discussion about what to do because science tells us what to do. And in a way, of course, science informs us and informs politicians about what is going on. So, of course, science tells us something about the world that no lay person could have figured out with her own means. But then, of course, what to do is also a political question. And the scientism I'm arguing against conflates politics and science and wouldn't leave room for democratic deliberation about what to do. That doesn't mean to ignore the facts. Of course, there are facts, like there is a virus and it's very dangerous, and there's a pandemic, and scientists, virologists can tell us what will probably happen if we do this or that, and we shouldn't ignore that. But it's a second step to make political decisions and to communicate these decisions. So otherwise we would live in an expertocracy. Is this an English word?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's still need for democratic discourse, even though we acknowledge that science can play a crucial role in this, or should play and will play a crucial role in this public sphere.
Actually, I think, I mean, of course, you could vote for a government of experts who just have a dictatorship and know what's scientifically recommended, and then they make the laws. But I wouldn't. I'm a Democrat, and I think there are good reasons for a democratic organization of societies. And again, I wouldn't make the dichotomy so strong. Democratic deliberation and decision-making processes must be grounded in facts, in knowledge about what's going on in the world. So, of course, citizens and politicians and everybody who as part of the deliberation, needs to be informed and needs to have a certain degree of scientific literacy to, and we see how important that is at the moment, to at least have a feeling and good intuition for what is serious science and what is pseudoscience, who can we trust, which research results are trustworthy and which aren't. And then based on these facts and knowledge, we can go into the discussion. I think that's what I want to say.
But again, these questions, of course, also can be answered democratically or under the regime of science already. So there is, of course, the idea that science itself tells us what good science is, whereas the problem is that maybe you indeed need to an outside criterion in order to tell good or helpful science from apart from pseudoscience or science that is not helpful. Do you think that science itself can tell us what it is to be scientific or good science?
Well, I guess there is not the science. There are a lot of sciences, and especially when in German it's die Wissenschaft, which includes also the humanities, not only the sciences, and of course every discipline has its special criteria what it means to be good social science, good philosophy, good biology, and of course we should take serious the criteria of the particular sciences. I wouldn't dare to say from an outside and a non-professional perspective, to say someone is a bad biologist or something like that. But I'm thinking, and I mean the particular scientific community has to decide in a way. But of course, the criteria can also change, and that's something that Kuhn told us, that perhaps what we consider normal science at one point gets overthrown by a scientific revolution, and then there's another paradigm, and then what counts as normal and good science is something completely different. So it's a permanent process of evaluating processes of inquiry. But I think my point was a little bit different, that even me as a layperson in respect to natural sciences should be educated to recognize if someone is, for example, an outsider in his community, and perhaps is doing has perhaps political interests, that's what I meant by scientific literacy. That any educated person is in the position to at least be critically aware of that not every person who has a sign on his shirt, scientist, is a person who tells the absolute truth. Perhaps I leave it like that.
So the absolute truth now brings us to the question of religion and God. And I assume that also in the one could put your position also in religious in religious questions as a kind of middle ground. It is not theistic, but it is also not atheistic. So it leaves open the door, as you write. It leaves open the possibility for believing, but it is not itself proposing a theory of absolute truth or God or a religious belief systematically. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a perspective I really strongly adopt from William James, who elaborated on the question of religion, or more exactly of religious experience in his Varieties of Religious Experience, and who struggled exactly with this question a lot. Like there's the option of a God who comforts me, who guarantees me life after death, but how does that correspond to my experience? Can I really, as a modern person living in a world that puts a lot of trust in science and is now even more than 100 years ago when James wrote, it's a secularized world in which belief is, or beliefs are only one option. Religious beliefs are only one option. Or there are a lot of options which faith I choose. And it is exactly that point where you think you need to believe something, and you don't want to just give you don't want to give into a naive faith, but you feel there is something about it. Now, what do you do? How can you take a critical stance towards your longing? And that's a question that James addressed in a lot of his writings, and I think is still and even more a question today for human beings. And I think the point about taking a humanist stand is exactly to acknowledge that need for certain I would say certainty, which we always should be very critical of. So I want something to be true, to be absolutely true. I want to know if I will have a life after death. I want to know, I want that someone tells me that life has a meaning, and what is the meaning of life? And it's okay to have this this need and this longing. But how do I manifest that need in my life? And do I have to say this is all a lie? So are religions only delusions or certain worldviews? Do I have to say that the universe has absolutely no meaning and that my existence has absolutely no meaning? Or is there, as you said, a middle path, finding meaning in human activity, and perhaps even leaving room for religious belief in a traditional sense? And I think it's possible to have a critical religious position that has room for doubt and isn't an absolute belief. And perhaps that's a radical answer that you could give with a pragmatist, that an absolute belief is that would be a case of self-delusion if there's no room for doubt.
So I wonder, the great neo-pragmatist Richard Rorty holds the position that you can believe whatever you want in your private sphere as a way of talking about yourself, giving meaning to your own life, and so on. But as soon as it enters the public sphere, so democratic deliberation about how to organize the society, you cannot refer to your religious beliefs. Would you follow this position?
Well, it depends. I do not follow Rorty in this strong private public separation, but of course for strategic reasons, if I'm a person with a strong religious belief, of course what I hold to be valuable perhaps is very much grounded, or not only perhaps, for sure is very much grounded in my religious beliefs. So if we have a public arena where we come together to talk about what our interests are and what values we want to be important, not only for our private life but also for society, I think it's very, very difficult for a strongly religious person to articulate their opinions without referring to religious language. And I wouldn't see a problem if we all just come together on the metaphorical marketplace and just tell our stories, tell our neighbors, our citizen neighbors, why we think a certain position is wrong or is valuable. And I wouldn't have a problem with religious perspectives in this kind of arena. But of course, if we have a political arena in the narrow sense, like a parliament or a Supreme Court, then of course we are going now in the Rawls-Habermas direction. It's problematic to articulate laws, for example, in a language that is not accessible to everyone, and that we should try to find a common language so that every citizen of a community, of a nation, for example, can at least translate it to their own vocabulary. You certainly realize that I try to evade an answer, because I think that's a very difficult question, and I think we should try to find a way to talk to each other, because that's something that gets more and more lost. A public discourse, an honest public discourse. And I think it's a good thing to try to bring as much as possible into that arena.
I think you gave a perfectly fine answer, actually. So I don't see you avoiding the question at all. And what I really like is that you try to overcome a kind of harsh distinction between the one position who says this public discourse should not be religious at all and should be completely freed from our religious experience, which we potentially as human beings have. But also on the other side, of course, the strongly religious perspective could be that this common language you talked about should actually be a religious language. So I think this position you also avoid, and to take a position that takes the religious or transcendent experiences seriously, but not completely giving into them or directly relating to them. These experiences, not relating them directly to already existing religious belief systems. So that's, again, I failed to to pose a question. Okay, I just tell you what I like about your book. That's also okay. Should we turn to the third topic? Because this maybe also is connected with the questions of what to do and how to justify what to do. And of course, one way of justifying doings is religious justification. Let's turn to ethics. You start off your ethics chapter with what you call a negative account of ethics, which you call failing better. I was really intrigued, and maybe you can tell us what you mean by that.
Well, that's of course something I've stolen. It's the famous Beckett saying, ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail again, fail better. And that's something that pragmatist philosopher Connor West also, which is central for his thinking, this idea of get away from the idea that you have to get it right or that's even possible to get everything right, but try to fail better. And you will always fail. You will always probably harm other people. You will not live up to your possibilities. But nevertheless, the idea is to have a learning process. And that's true for not only the individual level, but also for the social level. I mean, we have to be careful here that it's not something like an evolution to the better that is guaranteed. I think if we look into human history, it's pretty clear that humans don't get morally better and better and better. but still, that humans are able to learn. So it's not an automatic progress to the better. But there's a good chance, and there are good reasons to say that certain developments can be read, at least in hindsight, as a moral progress. But not because people discovered what has always been the right thing to do, but because they learned from their failures, the miseries that certain practices had. So it is this is what I call the via negativa, the negative or minimal ethics that is that does not try to say I have the absolute insight of what is the right thing to do, but I can point to practices, to certain values that are harmful, And we should try to overcome both practices. And then let's try something different. And perhaps this different turns out to be better. So this is a negative account.
You also draw the distinction between moral pluralism and moral relativism. And pluralism is also often connected to pragmatism, but also pragmatism is often called a relativistic philosophy. But you try to avoid the relativism. How do you do that?
Well, the question is if it really works, because I think the accusation of relativism is perhaps the one that any person who identifies as a pragmatist knows very, very well.
The moment I certainly do.
the moment you start to give up absolute truth objective realism, you get accused of being a relativist, and relativists are bad persons because you can do whatever you want and everything is morally right and you can pick whatever you want to be real, and that of course is a very bad thing. And I try to make clear that that's just not the case, that if you give up these absolutist thinking, you have to end up in this kind of relativism. And I think there are very, very few positions who are really, I think it's a straw man discussion to point to others and say that's bad relativism and you don't have any values at all. And what I try to anchor values in is interests and needs of sentient beings. Of course, this is no new move, but I think it's a very sound fundament. And I don't, to be honest, I don't see how the premise of God or the premise of the realism of values is more sound than look at the world and look at people or animals or other sentient beings that get hurt. Isn't that enough to ground moral behavior? So, of course, this is, as I said, no new move, but I think it should be enough to behave morally. And I do not see how... So the idea that only people who believe in God can be moral persons... is even plausible. So do you stop torturing your dog because you are afraid of going to hell or being punished in your afterlife, or because you really see and know and feel that it's wrong to do it? I know that's a very basic example, but
I think it is certainly enough, and it also connects with positions like Judith Schklar, who thinks that cruelty is the most the worst thing humans can do, and builds her complete political philosophy on this very simple assumption. So it is certainly enough for a big variety. Also, I don't think that she actually identifies as pragmatist, but for a big variety of theoretical concepts and positions. You end your chapter on ethics with a plea for a therapeutical turn of moral philosophy. So maybe you can explain what you mean that by this new task of moral philosophy.
Well, that connects to the insight that there was no, and there can be no universal theory about what's absolutely right and absolutely wrong. And this insight, turns philosophers into, or moral philosophers into specialists for a strange kind of theory. So I plea for a more concrete work of moral philosophers to be critical midwives for social processes. I don't know if this type of moral philosopher is still very, very common, but we should be careful if, no matter what person, but especially philosophers, enter the scene and say that they know what's right and what's wrong. And that's as to say that as if it would be a universal truth. And I think it would be really more helpful if philosophers would understand themselves as critical. Therapist is a very strong word, but I think the thing about the therapeutical turn is that it lays focus on helping people to find out for themselves and to develop into people with autonomy. And this means also moral autonomy, so that people are enabled to have their own moral compasses and to take responsibility for their actions. So this is meta moral philosophy in a way.
That's really nice to hear that it is a task of philosophy to actually help people instead of telling them what to do. So we have a little time left to talk about death. But I don't want to leave out this topic because it was also a great chapter to read. You start with the question, is death a problem at all? And I think for you, to a certain degree, it is a problem.
Well, yes, of course, this question alludes to one of the most famous answers to this problem that says, why should we care at all? Because it's not part of life. If you've died, you're dead, and that's it. We don't have to care about that. But I think, in a way, of course, this is a simple truth. But I think it gets wrong what people fear about death. It's not the fact that, it's not being dead, but it's dying. And of course, it's dying under certain circumstances. And it's the death of others, so it's the loss of other persons. And I think this is a problem. It's something philosophers should address if they talk about life, they have to talk about death. or at least acknowledge that you cannot evade to see that life is always a finite thing, and and I think this is something that it's still not done enough. So there's not enough mortalist philosophy. I know there's some people, but it's not the main thing. I think we still tend to say death is no problem, and it's no existential problem.
Well, Anna, in view of being to death, so Heidegger's famous Sein zum Tode, we've taken up a lot of your time. My last question is, what are you currently working on?
Well, my current book project, in a way, is a follow-up to Pragmatic Humanism Revisited. And I left out one big question that I hope to be the biggest question for the next centuries, and that's a question of our climate change, or better, climate crisis. And I think, of course, it's a scientific question. It's a question about facts, and so I'm not a climate scientist, but as philosophers, we could help to find ways to accompany the transformations we need to undergo as a society. And this is also has an existential dimension, because perhaps you know that in your circle of friends or family, what happens when we talk about this upcoming catastrophe? Everyone is either trying to evade or getting depressed. So how can we get a position that enables us to still be not panicking? And how can we try to be part of the transformation and not only passive objects of a change that will come if we like it or not? So I try to take the concept of meliorism that I also already introduced in this book, and try to elaborate on what could ecological meliorism mean. So that's my next project.
That sounds like a huge project and very interesting and urgent one. Anna, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Kai.